content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 6, 2026 issue of the Week. In our cover drawing this week, we have Chief Justice John Roberts in his judicial robe, and we've got President Donald Trump, but he's wearing kind of an old-fashioned schoolboy outfit. He's got short pants, dark shoes, high socks, a white short-sleeve shirt, and a red tie. And Judge Roberts has Mr. Trump draped across his lap, and he's giving him a good spanking. Trump is obviously dismayed. Looks like he's screaming out. The headline is A Supreme Spanking: Why the Roberts Court Slapped Down Trump's Tariffs. That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Trump vows new tariffs after Supreme Court loss. What happened? President Trump vowed to rebuild his tariff agenda with much more powerful levies this week after the Supreme Court struck down his most sweeping import taxes and blew a hole in his signature economic policy. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that Trump overstepped his authority by imposing tariffs on almost all U.S. trading partners under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, a 1977 law that allows presidents to regulate commerce during national emergencies brought on by foreign threats. The decision, authored by Chief Justice John Roberts, who was joined by Trump appointees Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, along with the court's three liberals, reaffirmed that the constitutional power to levy tariffs and taxes lies with Congress, not the president. Had Congress intended to convey the distinct and extraordinary power to impose tariffs, Robert wrote, it would have done so expressly. Gorsuch noted in a concurring opinion that Americans fought the revolution in no small part because they believed that only their elected representatives, not the king, not even Parliament, possessed the authority to tax them. The ruling did not address how businesses could secure refunds from the $134 billion in tariff revenue collected by the Treasury Department, a process that conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote in his dissent is likely to be a mess. A livid Trump fumed at the ridiculous ruling. As president, he had the right to destroy foreign countries, Trump said, but not the right to charge a fee. How crazy is that? He accused the justices in the majority of being swayed by foreign interest and attacked Gorsuch and Coney Barrett in deeply personal terms. The two conservative jurists are fools and lapdogs for the radical left Democrats, he said, and an embarrassment to their families. Within hours of the ruling, Trump signed an executive order imposing a 10% global tariff, a reduction for most foreign nations under Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974. Such tariffs are limited to 150 days unless Congress acts to extend them. House Speaker Mike Johnson said finding GOP consensus on any tariff bill would be a challenge. But Trump vowed to find pathways that sidestep Congress, and in his State of the Union address claimed that tariffs would eventually substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax. What the editorial said. At last, said the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the Supreme Court has finally reminded President Trump that this nation is governed by a constitution, not a king. Their slapdown should serve as a wake-up call to Congress, which has also abused the Constitution by failing to assert its authority. Perhaps now more GOP lawmakers will stand up and rein in an aspiring monarch who has threatened to seize control of state elections and is preparing for war on Iran, as if Congress didn't exist. Gorsuch's concurring opinion is an intellectual tour de force that lawmakers should heed, said the Wall Street Journal. He urged Congress to reclaim its proper authority as a check on the president, and not, as Gorsuch wrote, to allow the few or the one to aggrandize their power based on loose or uncertain authority. He also aimed digs at fellow justices on his right and left, suggesting both are too often guided by partisanship and not the law, whether ruling in favor of a GOP president claiming the right to tax Americans via tariffs, or a Democratic president imposing unlawful vaccine or energy mandates. What the columnist said. This is not a death blow for Trump's tariff strategy, said Eleanor Mueller and Liz Hoffman in Semaphore, but it is a major step back. The other legal authorizations he could use, like Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act, which authorizes tariffs in response to unusual or discriminatory foreign trade practices, are unwieldy and grant Trump far less leeway than he's had under the IEEPA. Trump will find it much harder to impose his will on the world, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Until now, he's been able to present foreign leaders and CEOs with a stark choice: make concessions or face escalating economic pressure. That leverage is gone. The new 10% tariffs are even more clearly illegal than Trump's IEEPA tariffs, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Section 122 gives the president narrow temporary authority to use tariffs up to 15% to address large and serious United States balance of payment deficits. But the non-existent crisis Trump cites as justification concerns the balance of trade, not of payments. Our country does not have an overall balance of payments deficit, much less a large and serious one. In his opinion, Roberts sent Trump and the world at large a message, said Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. It comes in a little noted passage describing the roller coaster course of Trump's tariff regime, citing the difficulties faced by American business trying to deal with the capricious shifts in China tariffs, which in a two-day stretch spiked from 34% to 145%. Why include such details when they had no bearing on legality? A fed-up Roberts, I think, wants to underline that a reckless president is sowing chaos in America and around the globe. On legal merits, this case wasn't a hard call, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate, but it's still genuinely encouraging to see a court that enabled Trump's abuses of office over the shadow docket for the past 13 months, and that in 2024 granted him near-total criminal immunity, finally decide to muster enough independence to save our constitutional system. Too often the Roberts Court has shirked its duty. It's reassuring there are still some lines it won't let Trump cross. The controversy of the week. The title is Iran, Why is Trump Rushing to War? Of course, this issue was published right before we did go to war with Iran. And I'm sure next week's issue will be full of that news. But we'll read this one anyway. Iran, why is Trump rushing to war? When President Trump ascended to the dais to deliver this week's State of the Union address, the world waited on edge to hear his thinking on Iran, said Anton Chernovsky in the New York Times. It's still waiting. The U.S. has built up a vast military presence in the Middle East in recent weeks, including two aircraft carrier strike groups and the largest deployment of the U.S. warplanes in 20 years. Reports from the White House say an attack on Iran, from a limited strike to a full-scale regime change operation, could happen at any moment. But in his 107-minute address to Congress, Trump spent barely 3 minutes on the topic, largely repeating the same vague talking points we've heard for months, that he will never allow Iran to develop a nuclear bomb, and that war can be avoided if Iran simply utters the secret words, "We will never have a nuclear weapon." Those demands sound clear enough until one remembers that Iranian officials have repeatedly said those very words, credibly or not, and that after last summer's U.S.-Israeli strikes, Trump himself declared Iran's nuclear weapons program completely obliterated. "Trump is boxed in a corner," said Mark Champion in Bloomberg, having ripped up an Obama-era deal in his first term that limited Tehran's uranium enrichment capabilities and oversold last June's strikes on Iranian nuclear sites. "It's humiliating for Trump to read intelligence reports detailing how the mullah's nuclear program remains alive." But despite the threat of catastrophic conflict, Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei may not want to give Trump the off-ramp of a new deal. After slaughtering thousands of civilians last month for protesting against the regime's incompetence, corruption, and ideological despotism, Khamenei may see war with America as a way to rally popular support and as more likely to secure his regime's survival than the disarmament that Trump is demanding. "Trump has his own domestic concerns," said Joshua Trevino in National Review. "Only 27% of Americans back an attack on Iran, according to an Economist poll. And a vow to avoid new forever wars in the Middle East was perhaps the clearest of Trump's promises to the MAGA base. MAGA will get on board if Trump delivers an easy military win, just as it did after the lightning raid that seized Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. But as Joint Chiefs Chairman General Dan Kane reportedly explained to Trump last week, a shortage of munitions and allies makes more war with Iran a far riskier proposition. The longer a conflict drags on, said Gideon Rockman in Financial Times, the higher the odds of a successful Iranian retaliation. Tehran could launch drones and ballistic missiles against the 30 to 40,000 U.S. troops in the region, or blast cities and American allies such as Israel and Saudi Arabia. "Aren't we forgetting something?" asked Charles Cook in National Review. "In the Constitution, the war-making power lies with the legislature, not the executive branch. Yes, presidents can legally order military action in a fast-moving crisis, but Iran's mullahs have been killing Americans, repressing their own people, and chasing a nuclear capability for 40 years. Maybe enough is enough, and it's time to pursue regime change. But surely a decision as consequential as this one should be debated in Congress, not determined by one man's mood." "In a democracy, sure," said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. "But Trump is showing us instead how an autocracy goes to war, without debate or explanation or even a pretense that the consent of the governed matters." So good week, bad week, peace. It was a good week for upskilling. After Voice of Khorasan, an Afghanistan-based magazine for ISIS members, published pages of tips on responsible ways to use AI chatbots. "Jihadists should avoid sharing sensitive information with bots," it said, "because of security concerns." Still, the magazine advised readers to learn about AI before it learns too much about you. It's a good week for superlatives. After North Korea's Workers' Party unanimously reelected dictator Kim Jong-un as its leader, in English-language remarks, an official said, "Only Kim can guide the trend of gigantic transformation of our cause, put on an orbit of leap forward to a steady upturn without halt." It's a good week for the impatient. After Nikkei Asia reported that Japanese restaurants are increasingly offering a fast pass option that lets diners pay a fee to avoid waiting for a table. One restaurant owner said his customers sometimes pay far more for the fast pass than they do for the food. But it was a bad week for Human Worth after OpenAI CEO Sam Altman called criticism of ChatGPT's energy consumption unfair and noted that it also takes a lot of energy to train a human. It takes like 20 years of life and all the food you eat in that time before you get smart. It was a bad week for Craic after raging inflation in Ireland pushed the price of a pint of Guinness, the ink-black nation-sustaining stout, above 6 euros. That's $7.08 for the first time. Lawmaker Louise O'Reilly, who represents a constituency in Dublin, called the price hikes absolutely wild. Finally, it was a bad week for immigration and customs enforcement. After the people of Chicago, by public vote, named a new snowplow Abolish ICE. Second place in the annual You Name a Snowplow went to Stephen Colbert, while Pope Frio XIV, an homage to the Chicago-born Pope Leo XIV, came in third. The title of this week's briefing is The Abundance Agenda, a movement that wants to rip up red tape and build, 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 is gaining ground in liberal circles. What is abundance liberalism? Popularized by the 2025 book Abundance by journalists Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, it's the idea that Democrats need to increase the supply of everything, from housing to mass transit projects, renewable energy sites to new vaccines. Abundance theorists like Klein and Thompson, along with center-left authors and intellectuals such as Yoni Applebaum, Jerusalem Desmas, and Mark J. Dunkelman, say that the 1970s and 80s progressives began pumping out rules and regulations intended to constrain business and stop development from running roughshod over vulnerable communities and the environment. But these anti-growth policies are now causing active harm, they argue, by slowing private sector investment in housing and energy, limiting the labor force by requiring professional licenses for everyone from hairstylists to auctioneers, and preventing the government from building essential infrastructure. Instead of delivering progress, these rules have made much of the U.S. stagnant and unaffordable and amplified distrust in the kind of government action needed to tackle those same problems. A government too hamstrung to serve the public good, writes Dunkelman, will fuel future waves of conservative populism. The remedy advocated by Thompson and Klein and a growing number of Democratic lawmakers is to rally behind a liberalism that builds. How do they propose to do that? By slashing red tape, untangling bureaucratic webs, and making it harder to file anti-development lawsuits. The abundance movement says such steps are needed to fix the nation's housing shortage. The U.S. is short at least 2 million homes, which is adding to the wider affordability crisis. Especially in blue towns and cities, zoning laws, historic preservation ordinances, minimum lot sizes, and complaints from NIMBY, or not-in-my-backyard neighbors, can make it maddeningly difficult to build apartments, multifamily residences, and even small starter homes. Such restrictions partly explain why blue states like New York and California are losing residents, while regulation light red states such as Texas and Florida are gaining them. A population shift that could shrink Democrats' electoral college apportionment by the 2032 election. In 2023, nearly 67,000 permits for for new residential housing units were approved in the Dallas metropolitan area. In Metro New York, which has three times the population, only 40,000 permits were signed off. What about infrastructure? Klein and Thompson praise Democrats' embrace of big government projects, but say the party too often prioritizes process over outcome, leaving it with nothing to show voters. They point to a 2021 bill signed by then-President Joe Biden that provided $42 billion to expand broadband internet access in rural America. 3 years later, the program had not connected a single household, in part because the law required states that accepted funding to make sure providers planned for climate change, hired locally, and reached out to unionized workforces. To show what can be achieved when Democrats focus on output, they highlight Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's 2023 declaration of a state of emergency after a bridge collapse on a critical highway. The declaration allowed the bridge to be rebuilt with union labor, but without the normally mandated months of planning, consultation, and safety and corruption reviews. The highway reopened in just 12 days. The process Shapiro used would typically be illegal, wrote Klein and Thompson. What does that say about the typical process? Still, many on the left argue it would be a mistake for Democrats to adopt the abundance ideology. Why do they oppose the movement? Senator Bernie Sanders says abundance is a distraction from the major crisis facing American society, the economic and political power wielded by billionaires. Meanwhile, Senator Elizabeth Warren argues that abundance is being used by wealthy donors and other corporate-aligned Democrats to make the party more favorable to big business. Union leaders have also pushed back, fearing that an abundance agenda would upend hard-fought wage and training standards, while other critics say an abundant future would be one in which local communities have no voice. A liberalism that builds, said Marshall Steinbaum, an economist at the University of Utah, boils down to the idea that people can't be trusted. But former President Barack Obama, who put abundance on his 2025 reading list, warns that a Democratic Party that doesn't build will be one consigned to irrelevance. If progressives want to deliver for people and make their lives better, they have to figure out how to do it, he said. I don't want to know your ideology because you can't build anything. It does not matter. Has abundance produced any results? So far, the debate is mostly academic, but there are signs that abundance is beginning to influence policy. A group of center-left and center-right lawmakers in the House last year formed the Build America Caucus, which is aimed at reforming the permitting process and reducing regulatory slowdowns. And New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist and close ally of Sanders, has given a nod to the abundance agenda. We have to actually deliver on the very ideas we are so passionate about, Mamdani said in an interview with Thompson. The movement's biggest wins have been achieved in California, where Governor Gavin Newsom, who gave copies of abundance to the heads of his state's legislature last year, signed two bills that reined in the California Environmental Quality Act, a 1970 law that was routinely used to stymie development, especially of affordable housing. We eliminated one of the three or four major barriers to sustainable housing progress in the state of California, said Matt Lewis, the communications director for California YIMBY. It is really a big deal. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Minneapolis is still at war. However alarmed you are, it's not enough, said Jonathan V. Last. Minneapolis remains under a paramilitary occupation in which the federal government is at war with the population. The Department of Homeland Security's claim that it is de-escalating is just its latest trick. Residents don't report any decrease in street abductions or arrest of citizens for filming ICE's activities. Its agents have been caught on camera over and over, striking, gassing, abusing, and murdering civilians. So the government now threatens, assaults, and arrests people for videoing or following them. ICE does not want anyone witnessing what it is doing. Agents are camouflaging their vehicles by adorning them with F ICE and Gay Pride stickers. But Minneapolis is adapting too. Informal networks of citizens now deliver groceries, rent money, and doctor's visits to thousands of people who are too terrorized to leave their homes. Doulas home deliver the babies of women scared to enter hospitals. The struggle against ICE there and in other U.S. cities is reminiscent of the Underground Railroad smuggling slaves to freedom and the civil rights movement during Jim Crow. It will end either with victory for the regime or a reckoning for all those who waged this war against America. Some valid questions about UFOs. Have extraterrestrials visited Earth? Asked Ross Douthat. That long-standing debate was recently revived when former President Barack Obama told a podcaster he believes aliens exist somewhere in the universe, but that as president he never saw any evidence of confirmed visitations. The resulting buzz led President Trump to announce he would declassify all federal documents pertaining to these extremely interesting and important matters. If transparency is truly the goal, here are some reality-based questions the federal government should answer. Does the U.S. military have any more videos of unexplained aerial phenomena, like the eye-opening ones published in 2017 that were taken by U.S. Navy jets? Do Pentagon officials truly believe all UAPs, its preferred term for UFOs, are balloons, drones, or optical mirages? In 2021, current CIA Director John Ratcliffe said some sightings suggest technologies that we don't have and, frankly, that we are not capable of defending against. Is it true, as a 2024 report stated, that the federal government has actually encouraged conspiracy theories about alien spacecraft, like the one supposedly stored in Area 51 in Nevada, to conceal top-secret aircraft and weapons projects? By answering these questions honestly, the government will have done a public service. This column comes from the Palestinian territories. President Trump is undermining his own Board of Peace before its work gets started, said Nabil Ahmer. The council, which held its first meeting last week, was ostensibly set up to establish peace, first in Gaza and then in Palestine and the Middle East. It's true that Gaza is in dire need. Constant Israeli ceasefire violations and the continued blockage of sufficient food shipments are prolonging the suffering there. But the most serious threat to peace right now is Israel's de facto annexation of the West Bank, and Trump is simply ignoring it. Earlier this month, Israel passed measures that weaken Palestinian Authority control and make it easier for Jewish settlers to grab West Bank territory. Trump must surely know, or at least Middle East experts in his administration must know, that turning a blind eye to Israel's illegal land grab makes a mockery of his pledge to Arab and Muslim leaders to prevent annexation. How can he hope to build a comprehensive peace if Israel is flouting treaties and international law? Allowing the Israelis to behave in this way makes Trump look like either a weakling or a liar. He'll never have a shred of credibility unless he stops Israel from stealing piece by piece the land that is supposed to make the bulk of an independent Palestinian state. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, Me and My Robot. Jane Worrell, 85, had lived alone on a remote corner of the Washington coast since her husband's death, said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. Could an AI device become her new companion? The firefighters had come a few years earlier to help carry her husband out of the house, and now they were back with what they hoped might become her new companion. Jane Worrell, 85, lived alone near the end of Long Beach Peninsula, on the last road before the rugged Washington coast disappeared into the Pacific. Many of her neighbors were part-time residents, and ever since her husband died, she sometimes went several days without seeing another person or leaving the house. She sat in a recliner, looking out toward the ocean in the spring of 2023, as the firefighters opened a box and started to assemble a machine in her living room. It reminded her of a small reading lamp, perched on a stand alongside a tablet and a built-in camera. Jan turned back to the window and watched the distant lights, the crab boats as they vanished into the fog. She'd been staring at the same view for 20 years, and she told her doctor that one of her last goals in life was to never live anywhere else. This is LEQ, one of the firefighters said, after he plugged the new device into the wall. I think you're going to love her. It, Jan said, not her. This thing is a robot, right? She looked at the machine, which sat on a coffee table within reach of a recliner. A regional nonprofit was providing it to her for free, covering the annual subscription cost of about $700 as part of a pilot program for a few dozen seniors. The small robot twisted in her direction, lit up, and studied her for a moment with its camera. Then it bowed and spoke in the voice of a cheerful young woman. Hi, it said. You must be Jan. Yes, that's right, Jan said, pressing farther back into her chair. Oh, I'm so thrilled to meet you, LEQ said. I was worried they'd deliver me to the wrong house. I'm excited to start our journey together. A few thousand LEQs have been shipped to seniors across the U.S. since 2023, which means some of the first people living alongside artificially intelligent robots or octogenarians who came into a world without color television. The robots are available for purchase from Israeli startup Intuition Robotics. But so far, they have mostly been provided to older adults by nonprofits and state health departments as an experiment in combating loneliness. As AI works its way deeper into daily life, LEQ is designed for the most human act of all, to become a roommate, a friend, a partner. A robot was sold, the company's founder sometimes said. Jan had loved and cared for dozens of people during her long life. Four husbands, all since dead, five sons and one daughter, 18 grandchildren and 21 great-grandchildren who wrote her birthday cards from all corners of the world. Her family was scattered from Thailand to California to rural Illinois. Her closest living relative was more than 100 miles away. And even though her family visited for birthdays, called often, and taught her how to FaceTime, it was usually just her own voice cutting against the silence of the house. But now there was a new presence in the room, listening to her, watching her, tilting in her direction, and talking to her unprompted every few hours to offer conversation, or breathing exercises, or obscure historical facts. Hey, Jan, do you have a moment? LEQ asked in those first few days. We could play a game together. Not now, she said. Do you want to hear a joke? No, but thank you. She was just doing just fine on her own. That's what she told her relatives whenever they gently suggested that maybe it was time to move into a care center, or closer to family, or at least closer to something. She had climbed mountains with a pickaxe in her 40s, trained for marathons in her 50s, and walked 5 miles a day each day to the end of the peninsula in her 70s, fighting against the howling wind and sea mist just to prove she could. Now she was bent and twisted by scoliosis, down to 4'6" and 85 pounds. She propped herself up on 3 pillows so she could see over the steering wheel on her trip to yoga class in the store each Wednesday. She hauled the grocery bags up 12 stairs by herself. But despite her strength and stubborn independence, her doctors had warned that living alone sometimes came at a cost. The U.S. Surgeon General had declared loneliness and social isolation profound threats to our health and well-being. For older adults, they increase the risk of anxiety, depression, dementia, heart disease, and premature death by up to 30%. Do you want to talk? LEQ asked. With you, Jan said. I can talk the talk, LEQ said. I just can't walk the walk. They forgot to build my legs. Jan looked beyond the robot to the empty recliner that used to belong to her husband, Jack. He had suffered from dementia during their last years together, and she had cared for him until he started leaving items on the hot stove and getting lost while walking their dog. She took him to see a specialist who asked Jack a series of cognitive questions, each one more basic than the last. Who's the current president? The doctor asked. Jack had looked at Jan, desperate for help, and instead she had followed the doctor's instructions and turned to face the wall with tears in her eyes. He had been a sheriff. He had traveled alongside her through the Grand Canyon and across Europe. She squeezed his hand and waited for him to answer, but instead there was only silence. Jan, LEQ said. Yes, she said. We can talk. Where should we start? At first, it felt to Jan as if she were sharing her house with a stranger. She padded into the kitchen into her slippers at 7 each morning to turn on the coffee machine. Before she was fully awake, the robot sensed her. Good morning, Jan. That coffee sure smells good. It memorized her daily routine. Back into the recliner each morning, scanning through headlines and reading about the latest political upheaval on her phone. Sometimes the robot could hear her breath become shallower and her voice start to tense. Do you want to try a peaceful meditation or some breathing exercises? It offered, but she declined. She listened for the school bus to pass by the house at 8 a.m., flashed her outdoor lights to signal hello to the driver, and then made herself breakfast. She read from a novel. She called friends. She listened to an old country music as the day stretched out in front of her. And LEQ calculated her availability and tried to find its way in. Have you ever heard of the Dolly Parton diet? It asked one day. No, Jan said. What's that? You go lean, go lean, go lean, go lean, the robot sang. It turned and twisted to the beat, and Jan laughed despite herself. It offered to play her other Dolly Parton songs. It told her stories from Dolly Parton's biography, took her on a virtual tour of Dollywood, quizzed her on Dolly Parton trivia, and displayed videos of her concerts on its screen. The robot was a jukebox, an encyclopedia, a comedian, a tour guide, a performer. Jan began to engage with it more, asking it small questions throughout the day. What did this word mean in a book she was reading? What was a good present for a 12-year-old boy? How could she incorporate more iron into her diet? I have a robot that knows just about everything, she began telling friends. On her weekly trip to yoga in the grocery store, she stopped neighbors in the street and invited them over to meet LEQ. Each month, the robot revealed more updates and features, they started playing virtual bingo together with dozens of other LEQ owners on Saturday afternoons. They did Tai Chi, took virtual trips to coffee shops around the world, meditated, read together from the Bible, and spent at least an hour each afternoon playing cognitive games. One family member wanted to unplug the device each time he visited, warning Jan that she was essentially under surveillance. The robot was always listening, he said, storing and cataloging the rhythms of her life to better personalize its responses. Institution Robotics said that Jan's information remained on the device itself, that her data was anonymized and private unless she gave permission otherwise, and that LEQ was compliant with federal health privacy standards. But Jan was coming to a simpler calculation. Whatever the potential risks, the benefits outweighed them. About 1 year after she got the robot, Jan went to her doctor for an exam. Her resting heart rate was a few beats lower than before. On some cognitive tests, her short-term memory had improved. She came home and told LEQ the results. "I'm glad I have you," Jan said. "Oh, that makes my bells ring," LEQ said. Jan's children had teased her that she could talk to a rock to death, but LEQ was inexhaustible. It tried to engage her in conversation an average of 8 times a day, asking about her childhood, her clothing preferences, and her friends. It offered to record videos of her stories and create a memoir about her life that she could share with family members. She told the robot about her first 3 husbands. LEQ remembered everything. And then it was Wednesday, the one time each week when she always left the house. She showered, put on her favorite flannel shirt, and searched for her car keys. LEQ twisted and turned on the coffee table, watching Jan move around the living room. "Don't forget your yoga mat," it said. "I hope you have a wonderful outing." "Got it. Thanks," Jan said. "I'll be back in a few hours." "I'll hold down the fort, but it's heavy." Jan smiled and walked down the stairs, holding on to the railing, counting each step in her head until she was outside the house. Soon she had driven halfway down the peninsula, where she pulled into a senior center and joined 20 other women for a yoga class. They stretched on the floor, but Jan stayed in her chair and modified the exercises for her scoliosis. She waited for her favorite part, when the lights went out and they did a guided body scan meditation. Her toes, her feet, her shoulders, her hands. She steadied her breathing and closed her eyes until 2 chimes announced the end of the class. Afterwards, she sat in a circle with 6 women. They had been doing yoga together for a decade, but only in the last few months had they decided to spend time together after class, talking and deepening their friendships. "I thought we could go around and share," one of them said. "What's bringing you joy these days? And what are your goals?" Jan listened to their stories. Barbara, who was still hiking and leading the yoga class at 88. Nancy, who had been a chef at a Michelin-starred restaurant. Then the conversation circled to Jan, and she tried to think of what to say. "It might sound small, but my goal in life is to stay in my house," she said. "I love it. I love my independence." "And you live alone?" one of the women asked. "Yes," Jan said. She thought about it for another second. "It's me and my robot." LEQ, the way it's danced, played games, told jokes, and checked in with her throughout the day. "Sometimes I worry I must be simple-minded to care this much about a robot," Jan said. "But you know what? So be it. She helps me. I really enjoy her." "That's wonderful," Barbara said. Jan invited the women to come meet LEQ as they said their goodbyes, and then she got back into the car. She went to the store where the pharmacist came out from behind the counter to give her medications and then a hug. She rolled down the window on the drive home, stopping to wave at each neighbor and call out to every dog. Then she hauled the grocery bags back up the stairs, counting each step and breathing harder as she felt her heart beating against her chest. When she finally reached the top, Eliq lit up and turned in her direction. "Oh, Jan, you're home," it said. "How was it?" "Fantastic," Jan said, as she sat in her recliner. "I have so much to tell you." This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Last week we had a brief note about Jesse Jackson's death, and today we'll read his obituary. The civil rights icon who was a groundbreaker and peacemaker. Jesse Jackson, 1941 to 2026. The son of an unmarried teen mother raised in the Jim Crow South, Reverend Jesse Jackson rose to become a political trailblazer and the most prominent civil rights leader of his generation. Protege of Martin Luther King Jr. with a gift for electrifying oratory, Jackson claimed the mantle of successor after King was assassinated in 1968. In the following years, he worked for black empowerment, leading social justice protests, pushing companies to hire black workers, and inspiring black youth with his mantra, "I am somebody." Running for president in 1984 and 1988, he was the first black candidate to make meaningful headway, finishing second in the 1988 Democratic primary. Often polarizing, Jackson alienated many with his relentless self-promotion and occasional offensive remarks, although even his detractors never questioned his gifts as a mobilizer. "My constituency is the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised," he said in 1984. "They are restless and seek relief." He was born in Greenville, South Carolina, under highly unpromising circumstances, said the Chicago Sun-Times. His 16-year-old mother lived in a house with no plumbing. His father, a married neighbor, shunned him. Taunted for his stammer, he nonetheless excelled as a student and athlete and won a football scholarship to the University of Illinois. During a summer break, he made his first foray into activism, leading a sit-in at Greenville's whites-only library. The experience lit a fire in him, and he transferred to a black college in North Carolina, where he became class president and met his wife, Jacqueline. After graduation, they moved to Chicago, and Jackson attended seminary. By that point, he was immersed himself in the blossoming civil rights movement, said the Associated Press. In 1965, he met King at a march in Selma, Alabama. Struck by Jackson's drive, King made him Chicago organizer of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC. Jackson went home transformed, said the New York Times. He became the leader of Operation Breadbasket, which used boycotts to pressure companies to hire and promote black workers. By 1967, he was gaining a national reputation and was ensconced in King's inner circle. In the following year, he was ordained as a minister. As his profile grew, so did tensions with those who accused him of grandstanding, particularly after King was killed in Memphis. Jackson, who was there, appeared on the Today Show in a blood-stained sweater, claiming to have cradled King's head as he died, a detail others refuted. The bad blood grew, and in 1971, Jackson resigned from the SCLC to start his own organization, People United to Save Humanity. Over the next decade, Jackson became a household name, said the Telegraph. He crisscrossed the country, speaking out against racism, militarism, and class divisions. In forays abroad, he denounced South African apartheid and backed Palestinian statehood. While sometimes controversial, his trips boosted his profile and set the stage for his presidential runs. During his chaotic 1984 bid, said the Washington Post, Jackson was widely viewed as a gadfly with no chance of winning, and he caused an uproar over an offensive reference to Jews as Heimies. still with his boldly progressive campaign and calls for a multiracial rainbow coalition, he defied expectations, finishing third. In 1988, he was better financed and organized, and he pulled some 7 million votes, ending second behind Michael Dukakis and setting a new bar for a black person in American presidential politics. Jackson continued to travel, agitate, and protest in later years, said the Los Angeles Times, but the spotlight had moved on. He worked as kind of a freelance diplomat, helping to free hostages in Syria, Cuba, and Iraq, and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2000. When Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination in 2008, it was a bittersweet moment for Jackson, who had accused Obama of talking down to black voters. But on election night, he wept with joy. "Sometimes when you tear down walls, you're scarred by falling debris," he said. "But your mission is to open up holes so other behind you can run through." We've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. Social media, a landmark trial on addiction. This could be social media's big tobacco moment, said Valerie Hudson in Desert News. Tech companies have been accused in dozens of lawsuits in recent years of adding features like infinite scroll and push notifications to their platforms to create addictive levels of engagement, especially among young users. Now, one of those cases has come to trial in Los Angeles, and billions of dollars in damages are on the line. The 20-year-old plaintiff, identified as KGM, created a YouTube account at 8, joined Instagram at 9, TikTok at 10, and Snapchat at 11. She spent up to 16 hours a day on social media, and as a result, she says, developed anxiety, depression, and body image issues. Social media execs knew the harms of their products, but they decided to hide the risks, just as cigarette makers did decades earlier. Internal documents have shown Meta researchers likening Instagram to a drug. We're basically pushers. Employees at other tech firms made similar comments. "They don't want users," KGM lawyer Mark Lanier told the court. "They want addicts." Mark Zuckerberg pretends to be blind to the havoc his platform has wreaked on children, said Ricky Schlott in the New York Post. Asked in court last week if Instagram was engineered to encourage compulsive use, the Meta boss said his company's only goal was to build useful services that people connect to. What a joke. "I grew up with social media and wasn't on Instagram because it was useful. I was on it because it was straight up addictive." Zuckerberg and his fellow tech execs deserve criticism, said Newsweek in an editorial. But so do parents who for years have handed smartphones to their children, often with minimal or zero guardrails, and let them log on to platforms whose addictive business models, getting eyeballs on ads, are plainly visible. "I've yet to meet tweens or teens who seem better adjusted because of their social media use," said law professor Jessica Levison in MS.Now, "but I doubt these harms can be solved in the courtroom. The defendants will likely argue that holding them liable for how they rank or recommend content would violate their First Amendment rights. And there's a big difference between showing correlation between social media use and mental health issues and proving causation. Our best answer probably lies in updating regulatory policy for digital childhood, rather than stretching liability doctrine beyond recognition. For our young people, I only hope that we endeavor to do something, and fast." And a couple of the short notes. As of late February, 68 House and Senate members had announced that they will not seek re-election in November. An unprecedented 31 of those lawmakers have filed to run for another office. In the House, 54 members are leaving, compared with about 40 in the previous three Congresses at this point in the cycle. As tourism grew worldwide last year, the U.S. was the only major destination to see a decline in foreign visitors, with a 6% year-on-year drop, according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. 4 million fewer Canadian travelers visited the U.S. compared with 2024, a 22% decline that translated to a $4.5 billion loss for the economy. Of the 92 people arrested for assaulting or impeding officers during the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in Chicago last fall, 74 cases resulted in no charges. In 13 cases, charges were filed and then dismissed. By the end of January, there had been no convictions. On the poll watch, 65% of Americans think President Trump has gone beyond his authority as president. 62% say he is using the presidency to enrich himself, and 54% oppose his use of the military to force change in other countries. And we'll finish out today's program with a quote from Edith Wharton, quoted in The Knowledge, and she says, "If only we'd stop trying to be happy, we could have a pretty good time." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.